morning, honorable members. Let me welcome the department, NUMSA, and the Faith Communities Environment Institute, ESCOM, and whoever is around as well. Today, we will be handling the last inputs or the last oral presentation, which is from NUMSA and the Faith Communities Environment Institute. Let me highlight, honorable members, obviously, these are oral presentations and what is left is submissions which do not have oral presentations, which we'll have to consider in any case. Before we then proceed to NUMSA making its presentation, let us get apologies from the committee secretary.
Thank you, Chairperson. Following apologies, Honorable Nukas, who's attending the Portfolio Committee on Transport, Honorable Selau, who's attending a joint meeting of the Portfolio Committees on Trade and Industry and Economic Development, and Mrs. Ferguson, who has a medical appointment here. Those are the apologies, Chair.
Thank you very much. Shall we welcome and invite NUMSA to make its presentation? Over to you, gentlemen. If you could introduce yourselves as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Just on behalf of NUMSA, I just want to make a short introduction. My name is Woody Arun, and I work at the Union's Parliamentary Office in Cape Town. And with me is a colleague, Mr. Dinga Sagwebu, who is the National Coordinator of Education for NUMSA. We'll be making the presentation jointly. Just to conclude the introduction, what I want to quickly point out is that we did make a submission on the 16th of April, 2012, and we followed it up with some additional comments and the documents on the table if you wanted. And what we'd do is that we'd speak more to the document that has our additional comments, because these actually have some of the most substantive concerns that the union wishes to raise. Very quickly, in our earlier submission, we acknowledged that some of the reservations that was expressed by Labour and NEDLAC, and we used that as our starting point, and then we did pick up a few things, and some of the things that we picked up, and this I must say, when we looked at the earlier version of the bill, the powers of the minister, and which we, at that stage, we thought was, you know, the section 25.1A, the earlier version of the bill, which was 13th of May 2011, had given the minister some very wide-ranging powers when it came to authorizing access to land and property. But the latest version, the 2012 version, in some ways mitigates that power. And what we find in the new version is that there is a provision there, section 35.3B, which actually says, well, if there's going to be any access to land where there's no electricity, then obviously they would have to seek, the person authorized to do so would have to seek permission to the courts. So I think that in some ways mitigates that power that the minister has. We also raised issues about the independent power producers, and there was a lot said in the memorandum about the independent power producers, and lots of emphasis on the private sector. And we raised certain concerns about that. We did touch on some case studies, World Bank models, for instance, in India, particularly with reference to the private sector, independent power producers from the private sector. And we say this because independent power producers aren't necessary, and that's our view, is that independent power producers don't necessarily mean the private sector. It could also be a mix of other collective forms of ownership. So, but the case studies that we refer to, particularly India, these were all modeled on the basis of the of World Bank proposals, and we made some reference to that because both in India there were concerns, and also on the African continent, in Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya, and so on, that some of the independent power producers from the private sector, their role was a bit dubious, and they didn't fulfill the mandates that they were given. But to cut a long story short, we did say in our earlier submission that we think that the one is that the state-owned enterprises would have to, or they should change their mandate from the current profit orientation to more to that of service provision, and that we should also change the existing forms of accountability. Instead of boards of directors appointed by ministers and other politicians, our discussion points on the need for significant representation of energy consumers and energy producers on new and legislatively empowered governing councils of these SOEs. Now, this is a point which we're going to pick up again in our in the submission that we're going to present today, in by way of the additional comments that we're going to make. Having said this, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Sekwebu, who will take us through these additional comments. And like I said earlier on in our introduction, we think these comments that we're going to make here are really much more substantive, and they certainly more detailed in the input. So with that said, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Sekwebu. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to members of the committee. The first thing I want to say is that as NUMSA, we are aware of the discussions that have happened in NEDLAC, but felt that it's important to make some oral presentation here as a union. And there are basically three reasons why we felt that that's important for us. The first reason is that NUMSA is one of the unions that organize at ESCOM. And in fact, the employees that are referred to in Section 40, subsection 5 and 7, about who are about to be transferred, seconded to ISMO, are our members. And we think we have an interest in what happens to their fate. The second the reason why we're here is that as a union, we have resolved on what we call the need to build a socially owned renewable energy sector. And by that, we mean a mix of different forms of collective ownership, which would include parastatals, but not confined to parastatals, but would be inclusive of publicly owned wind farms, cooperative, and other municipal-owned energy entities. We of the view that the dependence on the private sector and the narrow definition of IPPs to mean the private sector is not useful. In this regard, we feel that the establishment of a state-owned and publicly controlled ISMO is a necessary instrument and institution if we want to have these socially owned energy enterprises feeding electricity onto the grid. We are convinced that ESCOM cannot be a player and a referee at the same time. The third reason why we making an additional submission here, in addition to what we said at NEDLAC, is that as a union, we are the majority union in companies like BHP Billiton, ArcelorMittal, or what is called the contestable customers. And many times, speakers from this company always use our members' jobs as a bargaining chip, and we felt that it's important to speak for ourselves. Just to talk about some general comments on the bill. The first thing that we want to say is that as the National Union of Metal Workers, we support the bill, particularly the establishment of ISMO as a state-owned enterprise. And as we indicated in the introductory remarks, we feel that it has that potential to level the playing field for other publicly owned energy players. The second general comment that we want to make, and again, we want to emphasize, is that we are critical of what we see as the bill's underlying assumption, that ISMO is there to facilitate the entry in a significant sense of the private sector into the electricity industry. And this is quite explicit in the memorandum attached to the bill. And as my colleague has said, the way we see IPPs is that they need not necessarily be private, and that there can be other forms of independent power producers. And we talk about independent power producers, but it looks as if some people speak about independent private producers. The third general comment, and then this may be our sort of difficulty, is that we are concerned with the sort of with the piecemeal in which changes are being made to the industry without a explicitly agreed description of the end state of the sector. And we think that some of the disagreement at NEDLEC is because of this uncertainty about the end state. And we found it difficult for us, you know, whilst dealing with ISMO, and clearly you've got to look at the bill in relation with the amendments to the Electricity Regulation Act, and sometimes there are proposals there which are assumed in ISMO that they will come through, so we think that sometimes this is the source of some of the disagreements at NEDLEC. Just to talk about other comments, as we said about Section 2 about the objects of the Act. I mean, as a union, we support the fact that, you know, what is being established through this bill is a state-owned enterprise. We are uncertain with some of the sections, particularly the one that defines ISMO as a trader of electricity to ISMO customers, the definition of the ISMO customers. Because in the definition section, the customers are defined as both the suppliers from which ISMO will procure electricity and also the customers to whom the enterprise will sell electricity. That that is not helpful. But more seriously is the question of what happens to the customers that we organize. Who, like we're talking about the BHP bulletins, who have direct contracts with ESCOM. will come directly under the jurisdiction of the new enterprise. And we think that in the final version this should be clarified. The second point we wanted to talk about was the question of the transfer of assets. And here we support the provisions that call for negotiation between Eskom and ISMO. We particularly agree with section 40, subsection 1, C, Roman letter 1, that gives the minister the power to finally determine the values of what is going to be transferred in the event that there is no agreement reached between Eskom and ISMO. We know that this is maybe controversial, but our experience with the attempt to establish the EDI holding company is that the process of valuation can lead to a long, drawn-out process. And we feel that because ISMO will be a state-owned enterprise and that Eskom is a SOE itself, that the question of the transfer of these must be on a basis that puts the viability of the two enterprises at the center. And we know that there's been calls for session in the legislation of the market price as a way of valuing some of these assets, and we think that that may not be useful, and therefore we support the current provision on the transfer of employees. We support the provisions. Proposal that an insertion is made that the transfer of employees will be in line with Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act, which besides no guaranteeing contracts and all of that, makes the issue a matter of a bargaining between labor and employers. Just to conclude, and this is links up with our point about the sort of piecemeal nature. I mean, we would want to leave the committee with the question to consider. We know that it doesn't fall under the ambit of this bill, but with all the changes that are being made. Now, the establishment of ISMO with some of the powers resting in the department, the minister, whether it's not the time for something that was there in the past, which is an electricity council. Our feeling is that the sector is very complex and complicated, and that issues of planning, procurement, contracting, if they reside in different institutions, things may fall in between the cracks, and therefore we would want to for a discussion on the need for an electricity council that's advisory in nature, but that will ensure policy coordination. But that's all we want to do at the moment. Thanks, sir.
Honorable members, there's the input from NUMSA. Thank you. Governments, that I'm locked up. That is Male, that is Khalik, that order.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chief. I just want to establish certain facts from Noomsa. You seem to be having a problem with the notion of a board of directors, and hence you are advocating for the establishment of governing council. Can you just enlighten us? What are your challenges with board of directors, and what's the distinction? What's the major distinction? What's the fundamental difference between a board of a director and a governing council? Secondly, you are saying that, I assume this was also referred to ESCOM, where you say their mandates must be changed from current profit orientation to service provision. Can you just explain to us how you see the financial viability of ESCOM? In a nutshell, how do you want to see, because you're talking about service provision, as if there's a disjunction between service provision by ESCOM and their profitability or their financial viability. I seem not to be getting this point clearly. Are you saying ESCOM should just be providing services? If they run into financial problems, then they must come to the state to bail them out. They should never concern themselves about issues of financial viability. Can you help us to understand this statement? My last question, Chairperson, I'm not sure whether it is ideological, you seem to be having problems with the role of, which is minimal compared to the dominant role of ESCOM, the role of the private sector in electricity provision. Because the thinking has always been, you would want to have a situation where 70% of electricity is provided by ESCOM and 30% by the private sector. And that assures ESCOM a dominant role. So is that an ideological thing to say you don't want to see the role of the private sector at all in electricity provision? And I've never seen any way in our legislation where it outlaws or forbids the role of collective, I'm trying to look for your way, collective organizations or cooperatives. So it's up to, if cooperatives want to be IPPs, and I don't know anywhere in the legislation, this current legislation or formal or any other legislation that has been passed by Parliament that forbids cooperatives from forming IPPs. So it seems the way you put it across is as if we are saying it should be strictly the private sector and no cooperatives can be involved in the electricity provision. I think just the last one, you made a statement where you say ESCOM cannot be the player and referee at the same time. Is that statement not implying that already you're factoring in involvement of other players? And by extension, one would assume that could include in the private sector when you say they cannot be a player and a referee at the same time. Why, when you support the introduction of ESCOM. Thank you, James.
That's noted, Honorable Smart.
Let me just say that your argument that the minister must decide should there be a deadlock between ESCOM and ISMA, we can't it is the same shareholder. Therefore, the shareholder decides what should be implemented, and as the shareholder, then the decision gets implemented. The shareholder, in this case, being the state. You know, in order to determine how it goes.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It is heartening to see that you do fully support ISMA, which is great, and I think that we are getting general support for it across the board. It's also heartening to see that you also want an end state for electricity, which is something which ESCOM also brought up, and which I think is desperately needed, something which we're going to have to push for, because I think that the problem with piecemeal legislation without that end state in mind is we could have unintended consequences, so I fully support that. My comments are just around, you talk about collective ownership, such as energy parastatals and publicly owned wind farms. What has your experience been so far in terms of the rebid process? Because I think that this speaks to the kinds of issues that might be holding back such collective forms of ownership. And, you know, ISMA isn't necessarily going to completely change that landscape, but I think that if there are particular hindrances at the moment, then we need to identify those and deal with it. In terms of what I've noticed in terms of the process so far is that it is hugely costly to put proposals together, and I think that is probably what is holding back some of these collective forms of ownership and small communities being able to group together and do that. I do know of one wind farm, though, in Saldana, I think it is, where they have set it up as an NGO, where there is community ownership around it. So I'd be interested to hear whether you've participated in the rebid, whether you've encouraged your members to do such things, and what the problems are there. If I can also just say, though, that I think one of the problems at the moment is that the allocation for small projects is only 100 megawatts given by the department. And I think we need to increase that allocation, because it's the small projects that are less than 5 megawatts that probably have the greatest potential for this type of ownership. So I'd just like to hear your comments around that, to see how, because this is also my vision for renewable energy. I'd also like to see this type of projects mushroom. And if they're not at the moment, we need to identify what those problems are and how we address them.
One on the minister and the role of the minister in determining if there's a deadlock. I mean, we think that the shareholder is the shareholder on both sides. And I don't know whether this was raised in any other submission. As I said, the experience with the EDI holding, there was an elaborate process of valuation of the assets and going forwards and backwards, instruments that were established. And I'm not saying that's the reason why the EDI holding didn't go forward, but we think that that can lead to a very long drawn out process. We also of the view that ESCOM, when the transfer is happening, its financial standing mustn't be compromised. But at the center of the negotiation between the two parties should be a broader vision of the industry, of the viability of the two enterprises. And we don't know what ESCOM would sort of insist if ESCOM says, look, market price for all the assets, the intellectual ones, the tangible ones, and how that would affect the new enterprise. So basically what we're saying is that I'm sure in the negotiation someone will the opening gambit would be market valuation of all this of these assets, and we feel that it may compromise what is being planned here. So if I got the answer, we think that what's in here in the bill about the minister deciding, we support that. That let the negotiations, let the parties negotiate, but if after a while there's no agreement, the minister will have to, the shareholder, decide on this question. The second question I wanted to sort of deal with is the one about our experience with the rebid. And to just say that we had a international conference in February looking at the renewable energy and what's possible. And one of the decisions that we took was that as a union and with our members, we should look at the next windows where we could set up cooperatives as a union and enter and sort of bid. Now, the clearly in the sort of some constraints, and the constraints are sort of financial. I know we know that there are for broad-based black economic empowerment initiatives. There's the DBSA assistance. But when we looked at some of the documents and what is required and the guarantees that you need for every megawatt that you propose to generate, and our feeling was that you know, although everyone from the department, including the minister, said, look, there's nothing that says that you can't be an IPP, but the financial hurdles that you would have to jump. And basically, we think that the socially owned or cooperatives or collective forms of ownership will be the small projects. And basically, we think we're back to the two nations. Collective forms of ownership, they're the lower rung, and you can't enter the other field because of some of the financial hurdles. So we still committed as a union to we're putting up consortia, including some of NUMSA's sort of investment company. Partly of it is also to test the program, to test the program and all the assurances that we've had from high up, and whether there's a commitment to open up the space for that. And this is not just ideological. I'll come to the ideological question. This is not just ideological. We think that some people have said to us, oh, look, I mean, we want the private sector to take the risk. Why do you want to put public money in that? We think that's not sometimes fair as a comment, because who underwrites the projects that the private sector will initiate? Who provides the guarantees? And our reading of that is that the National Treasury, at the end of the day, some of the agreements that are there, stands as a guarantor. So to just portray this is just private, we don't share that that person. So there is a pragmatic side about just how to set up these, and we think that with a government that's committed to job creation, poverty alleviation, these sort of community-controlled renewable energies that are able to feed onto the grid, or maybe supply energy in local communities, is an important initiative. So that's our sort of experience on this. Let me just start from the beginning and take up some of the questions. I mean, as a union, let's say, as a union, before the corporatization of Eskom, we used to sit on what was called the Electricity Council. And the way the Electricity Council worked is that it had consumers, it had customers, the shareholder had some appointees there, and basically the stake, it was sort of a stakeholder driven council. With corporatization of Eskom, that was done away with, and we objected to that, went onto the streets, but as things happened, that went ahead. Now, we're not coming from this, that look, this was our position then, but our feeling is that, and I'll come to the, our understanding at the moment is that the question of a we have now the IRP. The question of constant updating, you know, with IRP 2010, in 2 years' time, we're supposed to start working on that. We were called recently to a colloquium on integrated energy planning. We started with the IRP, but the overarching integrated plan is only now being worked on. The question of procurement of new generation capacity resides in the minister. Is mobile coming now? We have NESA. If you look over the years, there have been this proliferation of these institutions of different powers. And our feeling is that, as I said earlier, things will the chance of things falling in between the cracks, and we think that the idea of an electricity council, and we're now introducing this as sort of an advisory and sort of for policy coordination, where some of the institutions like ISMO, the generators, customers, the department, can ensure that everything is moving in tandem. As I said, we sort of, at the moment, say, look, this is sort of an advisory electricity council. I think that, I mean, just now, so that I don't sound like ducking the question, at that point, we felt that the sort of moving away from a notion of an electricity council and the insistence on boards, and this was also part of making the SOEs sort of, you know, the question of profit, financial viability, became uppermost than the service, and we felt that that was the problem. The idea that we're putting forward to think about is an advisory council on electricity to ensure policy coordination as move forward. There was an issue about the sort of a private sector. Is this just an ideological? I mean, I know this sometimes when people say it's ideological, it's, you know, just a blackmail. It's just, you know, there's no rational reason. It's just, you know, your ideology. Look, I mean, and Woody can sort of talk more about some of the experiences. Is that our feeling is that electricity and the supply of electricity, whenever that has been sort of broken up, I mean, the experience of the breaking up and introduction of the private sector has been, recorded how disastrous that has been, and I think if we come to ISMO, we think that the memorandum annexed to the bill doesn't make as the motivation the question of entry of other forms of ownership onto the grid. In fact, it says that this is to facilitate the private sector's entry into that. And we think that's a... I mean, if people say, look, there is nothing in our law that says socially owned, publicly owned, cannot enter. To have a memorandum that this bill is to facilitate entry of the private sector, it is this underlying assumption that we want to point to, and we think that that's incorrect. We have gone high up and said, look, IPPs, and we're told IPPs need not necessarily be private. We said, okay, but the memorandum says ISMO is there to facilitate the entry of the private sector. Now, but what about the cooperative that we want to set up in Free State, a NUMSA cooperative? Now, that's not private sector, and the reason we support ISMO, we support it so that cooperative can feed electricity onto the grid, and that's the argument. I think, I mean, in response to our experience, although there's some nothing says that if you are a cooperative you can't enter, I think that outlaws that. But the way the program has been crafted, and it makes it difficult. There's some discussion with the department on this matter. They've been at our conferences to talk about this, and we've agreed to have an ongoing discussion on it. But that's the end. We want to go that route, experiment, and see what happens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I just want to emphasize the point a little more. Is that the you're right, the bill itself doesn't make, and this is a debate I have with my colleague, is that the bill itself doesn't say that independent power producers is justified. That's in the memorandum, and that's where the thing comes from. And that's where these assumptions, and that's why my colleague says there's this underlying assumption. It's in the memorandum, not in the actual bill itself, which is the memorandum, which is attached there. But I was also there at NEDLAC when the bill was first presented at NEDLAC, and they presentation was made from the department. There was absolutely no mention that there could be other forms of ownership. It was heavily, and which is why if you look at Labour's submission at NEDLAC, you'd see that the Labour submission it rests primarily on the role of the private sector, and that's their concern, which is why when they participated in the task team and NEDLAC and drew up this report, we looked at this report, we got a copy of the report, we looked at it, and we could see that, look, okay, it's understandable why there was this concern and why there was this about the private sector. But it also ties in, and I think
colleague has pointed this out, but our own experiences, we've been engaging the department now, not on one occasion. We've been engaging the Department of Energy. We've been engaging DTI, Science and Technology. And when it came to the bid, when it came to, remember you had the refit model, and you shifted to the bid process, and we asked questions about that, so that we ourselves could get some clarity. We found it very difficult to get the bid document, because you had to pay 15,000 rand to get the document. But we eventually, through our sources, managed to get the sections that we wanted. We were concerned about what was the provision of local, what was the provision of local content in this bid document. Before we even looked at that, it was the Department of Science and Technology that said to us, look, there's really not much here, except there's a 30% here, but it's confined to the site preparation and construction phase. So we said, but where's the transfer of science, where's the transfer of technology then? So we had to take this as, well, not just ESA, but this is what's coming from official sources. Science and Technology is telling us about the bid document and what is in the bid document. And of course, that set the ball rolling, so we had to make attempts to try and get sections of the bid document so we could actually study it and see, but what is there about local content and how far does it go? Or are we just simply, it's going to be at the construction phase? Look, we know the construction industry. It relies heavily on what they call labor-only outsourcing, subcontracting, right? Very poor wages. There isn't really an element of decent work, except for those who are artisans and much more highly paid. But the rest of the work in the construction industry is works on the principle of what they call LOC, right? Which is labor-only subcontracting. And it's an industry that's fragmented with this layer upon layer of subcontracting. So we did our homework a bit. So we just didn't want to take pot shots and say, which is why we didn't say, we looked at the bill and we were debating this. We said, look, where do we go on this bill? And which is why we found, well, look, there are things in this bill that we can support. And the bill does open up spaces for this. If it opens up spaces for, well, private sector is there, but collective forms of ownership will have to, and if there's possibilities of that happening and they can get their act together, they can get the resources, well, let's go with that. I'll stop there, Mr. Chairperson. Thank you.
No, we listen attentively. You don't have to rush. You still have all the time. Not all the time, of course. NUMSA's impulse is quantitatively very, very, very short and terse, but NUMSA is raising very profound issues. Very profound issues. Of course, take into account, honorable members, that some of the issues are not necessarily focusing on the bill itself, but they address the broader environment. But we've already alluded to that, that at some stage we'll have to look at this as a project within which the legislative process is just an integral part, because it's an operation shake-up of the electricity supply industry. Of course, having to play around as to how it links with the distribution industry as well. Thanks for reinforcing that. Anyway, obviously, we're not around when begin to realize that. Just a few things. I will make comments, but just a few questions from my side. In your original submission, you made reference to that. To what extent does the ISMO bill level the playing field? Now, I wrote here, in what way are the playing fields not level currently? I just was interested in that, unless you feel you have already alluded to that. As a matter of interest, you made reference to quite critical of the current practice of IPPs or privatization, and it seems in the bottom, the second and third pages in the presentation, the original submission, you allude to that. Can you raise them again, of course, we'll appreciate we don't want to leave any stone unturned here, particularly when it comes to definitions of customers and service providers, particularly service providers in this country. What are your concerns
amongst other things, this bill is about the facilitation of that.
You've raised the issue of a piecemeal approach a couple of times. Sure, honored members were sensing that from our side as well, but you must bear in mind that there is pressure now. We have to have this mobile like yesterday. And this mobile is also, I mean, if inshallah, this mobile is promulgated by the president within this year, we still have to have another 2-3 years of incubation, isn't it, Descom? Something like that, you know. Because this is a major shake-up, you know, changing an institution so well-established and, you know, with all its systems like ESCOM. That's the indication that came from the department. How it's done, I don't say let's go into that. But also, you're raising a pertinent issue, which is we have IRP instead of IEP, Integrated Resource Plan instead of Integrated Energy Plan. I'm sure we'll all as South Africans take blame on that because we dragged our feet in doing the appropriate planning. But at least let's give the department a cue because the Integrated Energy Planning process has started. It's very complex. I'm sure we'll all appreciate that. And I trust and hope, notwithstanding, we'll still give our support and involvement and contributions to the IRP, because also one of the key characters of the IRP is that it's an iterative process. The department owes us this year, isn't it, that we should have another round on the IRP. I'm sure all of the members will be looking at the third term and see if we can give space to the department to come. But all and Sandra will be involved. My question is then, amongst a few things, if you then see the memo does not encourage or focus other forms of ownership, especially social ownership, are you implying that there should be a redefinition of the service providers in the bill? You see, why I'm provocative in that way is that you can raise a concern, but it must be clear what impact must it have on the bill. Can I leave it there for now? Oh, you were concerned about the definition of customers. I missed you there. If you could just repeat that, and also repeating the concerns about the future contracts with key customers, your big BHP, Billiton, Salomitas, and others. Why I want you to have another bite on that is because this has been raised in the past, so just be a little bit elaborative on that, so that we can see how we apply our minds on those. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with the customers. When we looked at the bill, we looked at the sections that section 2 that states what the objectives of ISMO would be, and one of those is that ISMO would be the trader of electricity to ISMO customers. So our understanding of that is that it will sort of sell to customers. question on definition. And when we looked at the definitions, we find that I think they are customized, defined in four categories, which includes customers, the suppliers, which in this case would be the people who generate, from which ISMO would buy the electricity, but also those that it will sell to. So there's a sort of a dual, that definition is, includes both the suppliers and the people to whom ISMO would sell. That's our reading, and we think that's a bit unhelpful, and that maybe the definition, the splitting up of that is important in the definition section. A second point, besides now that about how it's defined, and the way we understand how the situation is, moment, and this may not be. Let me just say how we understand it. Is that there are Eskom generates, transmits, and gets the electricity onto the grid, and it gets to the distributors, and some customers are served by Eskom and others by municipalities. But besides that, the companies that we organize, when we are alone, we call it the big electricity guzzlers, the big ones. Those ones have contracts with Eskom. They are supplied directly by Eskom, and some of them have a sort of long-term contracts, and the rates and the confidentialities and all of that are included in this contract. Now we wanted to know the jurisdiction of ISMO if it's a, as it's defined, that it's a trader of electricity to ISMO customers, will it include this group of special, and some of them it's a book can be written about how all these contracts are, but I mean these are the people who mainly constitute the what is called the energy intensive users group. Will they, those contracts, when they are transferred, when there is a transfer of a contract, will that be transferred to ISMO? And would ISMO have a control over the nature of these contracts? Clearly, because they are contracts, they'll have to run their course. But is it meant here that from then on, when they lapse, everyone comes into the ISMO system? Or will the Eskom contract continue? That's what we want to know. Now, our employers, or the employers of our members, have always put this as the question of their security of supply. You know, you can go to NERSA, you can make public submissions, but they've got a window to Eskom. And this has sort of meant, the way we understand it, that the system caters for sort of captured customers, contestable customers, and we just wanted to know. I mean, it's not clear from our reading, although we say that we would want a sort of a uniform system, but it's not clear as the bill stands. And we think that that's important to be clarified. It's important to be clarified. So that's the issue. second point, Chair, was about leveling the playing field. Now, our study is that we looked at different models of systems operators, and what we felt is that, or what we were able to find out from our research is that there are two, you could classify systems operators into what sometimes is called a shallow systems operator or a deep systems operator. By deep is that the systems operator will also own transmission. Meaning it owns the sort of the grid, the ownership. Now, the way we understand this is that at the moment we are taking, as proposed as a country, a bit of a phased approach. Now, I know that maybe some of the, strongly sort of free marketeers, break it up and take it out of ESCOM and all of that. We support the phased nature of this. We are an engineering union, and we think that sometimes you've got to be practical about how you do things. Because in the haste of doing things, you may disrupt processes. So we feel that the question about is it leveling the playing field, we haven't gone deep in terms of a systems operator that owns the transmission and all of that. And we think that that sort of pragmatic way at this moment required, and we don't think that it disadvantages other players. I don't know whether I'm answering that question. Woody, there were questions about the experiences and service provider.
Just in response to the question of the international experience, now there's a wide range of literature on the subject, but one of the UNEP report, which was United Nations Environmental Program report on electricity reform, social and environmental challenges, which was edited by experts in the field, there were a number of studies in this, and one of them was, they looked at India, and the whole electricity reform process in India is not unlike what we went through here in South Africa. It's almost a duplicate. And if you look at other parts of the continent as well, it's the unbundling and the separation of, for instance, generation, transmission, distribution, and so on. Allowing for private participation. It's a very similar example. They're not kind of different from each other. The problem with India, and this is the writer's views, that it was the state of Orissa which was used as a model, and this particular state followed the World Bank's model of electricity restructuring. But it came at a cost, and it came at a cost because policymakers were actually policymakers in India felt that they were actually sidelined, and that the bank had this, or that the bank was using its powers to influence this change, and it did this through what was instruments of conditionality. So there's all these conditions, and they felt that these conditionalities was a problem, and this is often comes up from critiques of the World Bank is that the bank does something, and it does something by way of saying, look, it doesn't really do it as an act of charity. Sometimes these things do come with conditions. They don't just give you money without attaching some conditions or without asking for some kind of reform that fits in with the kind of paradigm that they want.
And I think this is where the problem was in India. But coming back home on our own continent, it was the issue of privatization, the issue of outsourcing electricity to private producers. And some of them who actually came from our own country, investing elsewhere on the continent. But problems that emerged again was that they would come in, come in on the basis that it's going to make substantial investments, and only to find that those investments were not forthcoming, and then they start to look at local capital to actually fund their ventures. Other issues came up of poor service delivery, issues of the quality of products used of a very inferior quality. It's not as if these things happened without problems. We're going through a process now, and I'm sure the private sector would come in, but they're not going to come in just on some big philanthropic group, that's here for charity. They're going to look. Private sector works on the basis of there must be some returns to their investments. And they're going to look for those returns. But the kind of services that go with the return that they expect, we would have to see this. We'd have to follow this. We'd have to monitor it. I think when it came to electricity reform and the problems of power outages and so on that we experienced earlier on, of course, everyone was also talked about the California example, which we never use here, but there's also one of the examples. And there's an extensive amount of research done by the Deutsche Bank on this, on the California one. And you had a very weird pricing system there, where you had all these competitors selling electricity, generating and selling electricity. And, of course, the competition became so fierce that the wholesale prices actually, in relation to what the retail or the regulated price was completely skewed. And there were other factors as well, but it led to crystal supply and demand and so on. But it did lead to a collapse of the system. So this thing about what constitutes a wholesale price and what is a retail price, if the one exceeds the other in a very abnormal way, one expects wholesale prices always to be less than what your retail prices are. But if one exceeds the other and creates an abnormal price distortion, you're going to have problems. So the thing about international experience, so this is what we're saying to the portfolio committee, that we must read, because in one of the presentations that the department did to us, they were very excited about the private entry of private producers into the market, and into particularly with reference to electricity. But there was no, or there didn't seem to be any reference to, well, look, what kind of problems, what has been the experience internationally? We're not saying it's all a bad experience, but clearly from some of if you look at the, like I said, the United Nations report, other reports, there's a wide range of literature on the subject. And I think the departments would have to look into that. We can't just accept that. That's the best way to go about it. Simply because they're making an investment, we would have to look at it very carefully. That was the thing on the international experience. I don't want to go into too much detail there. I think the playing field. When we put this in our earlier submission, we put it as a question, really, to what extent? Because I think my colleague has made a lot of reference to the thing about customers. And that is a concern. I mean, the thing about existing contracts between Eskom, the energy-intensive users group, how will that still be kind of classified contracts? Will those contracts now come in under ISMO and be open? If we're going to have a level playing field, these things would have to be addressed. I think the piecemeal manner was dealt with. We want policy coherence, and we can't. Yeah, we'd have to ensure that there's overarching policy coherence, and that we bring them into line so that we it is better better coordination. Because it has, I mean, this year itself, we've had bills, the electricity, what's it, regulation amendment bill, there's something on NERSA, ISMO came up last year. And when you sit sometimes at NEDLAC, you sit in the Trade and Industry Chamber, you go to a meeting, a monthly meeting, and then there's these presentations. So there's a kind of rush of these things, which is maybe it's unavoidable from the department's point of view. But overall policy is important. Overarching policy, so that we understand this is the overarching policy, and these are all the other subsections. This is how it fits in. So for us, these are very, very important issues which we think the department have to consider. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much, Namsa. I'm sure you're not the only one who raised this need for a policy coherence. Of course, we'll take that up at a later stage. And the department is all ears on that matter, definitely. Your issues about the customers, particularly the electricity guzzlers, one has really taken note of those questions that you're raising. We'll be looking forward to get a response from the department on that, particularly the use of classified contracts vis-a-vis transparency, which we would like to enhance by all means, as well as your emphasis around social ownership. But of course, taking to note what Honorable Mlod has said as well, the extent to which there's exclusion. But if there's a need for emphasis, let's see how those expertise in the field can ensure that's taken into account. Of course, the issue of appropriate institutionalization, which you refer to as the National Electricity Council, will take note of and will handle it, it's at a later stage. Thanks for that for now. Obviously, it has been triggered by this process, albeit outside it, as you also had noted. Can you also share the UNEP report for us for just general reading? That could be helpful. One other thing you've just triggered is that as we went along this journey, particularly by the department, in what way and to what extent had the department done any risk assessment? Because that's very, very important. I mean, there is no turning back. We're introducing or facilitating the introduction and participation of IPPs. But alongside that, we need to ensure risk assessment that we will take note of. In that case, one of the members, shall we? Then thank NUMSA. Oh, by the way, also the issue of phase transition, definitely. The department has highlighted that very, very strongly. I'm sure they'll be encouraged to note that one submission after another has made a very strong emphasis on the fact that there's a need for a phase transition. That's definitely acknowledged. Thank you very much. Can we then move to the Faith Communities Environment Institute?
I just want to say one very quick remark. We thank the committee for giving us this opportunity. I should have said this at the beginning. And I want to apologize for our general secretary who couldn't make it because he's busy preparing for the Congress that's coming up in a week's time. And unfortunately, we'd like to stay for the other presentations, but we have to rush off to Johannesburg. So So we don't want the committee to think it's rude that we came here, put our stuff and we ran away, didn't listen to anybody else.
No, that's part of parliament life.
Let us center ourselves and lead you in peace. Let us remember who we are as spiritual beings. O thou who art the Lord of grace abounding, let thy celestial aid surround those who love thee and bestow upon us the gifts and the bounties thou dost. Be thou sufficient unto us of all things. Forgive us our sins and have mercy upon us. Thou art our Lord and the Lord of all created things. No one else do we invoke but thee, and nought do we beseech but thy favors. Thou art the Lord of bounty and grace, invincible in thy power, and the most skillful in thy design. No God is there but thee, the all-possessing, the most exalted. Confer thy blessings, O my Lord. Verily, thou art God, the fearless, the all-compassionate. Peace be upon each one present.
Thank you very much. And then, just to also say that we believe that this is a very historic occasion in terms of restructuring of I just want to really say appreciate, firstly, the committee and the way that you've given us space to speak to issues in the bill in depth and considered it, and particularly having bodies like NEDLAC here, I think it's been really valuable. And I also want to say that I really appreciate the department, because when I sat down to write the response to this parliamentary hearing, I sat down and, in fact, almost drafted the first paragraph berating the department for not listening to me before I even read the second version of the bill. Then discovered that, in fact, a lot had changed. And I really think that the department has really attempted to address many of the shortcomings in the first version, which is why you will see that in the 14 pages that I submitted, that I did it in a manner that we can look at what was in the original and then what I feel has been addressed by the department to a large degree. So I really want to commend the department for that. For this morning, what I would like to do is just pick up a few key issues, and sort of overarchingly how I feel, you know, that the ISMO fits in terms of the context, and then move to some of the specific legislative amendments. And the key issues, I think, is which have been raised by many submissions, is what do we do with transmission? How do we structure the ISMO, and what its role is in planning of electricity? So I just also asked one of the previous speakers if I could borrow a slide, because I think just in terms of looking at the context, we had one of the previous speakers spoke about how much has happened or hasn't happened in terms of renewable energy. So just to remind us that we are sitting with a little bit of a block there. And then this has just been raised this morning, and in other, and just to give, you know, if one had to look for me, where do we start? You know, on the left-hand side, we should have an overarching energy policy, then we would have an energy plan, then we would have overarching legislation, and then we might have subsets of legislation, for example, the ISMO, and then within that we would have an integrated electricity plan. What we actually have is policy, then IRPs, then ISMOs, then legislation amendments, then suddenly an integrated energy plan, so which is due to be done by the... And I just want to highlight that that's the context which we're working in. And then it's been a question for us: is where are we going with this, with our electricity reform? Where's the end state? And in trying to gain an understanding, I actually phoned the department and asked them, do they have a memorandum of where they're going in terms of way forward? And I was informed that there was nothing that was publicly available. So it's a little bit difficult, therefore, to comment in the vacuum. So if we reflect on what do we want and what do we have, to me, we would like to have a strong Department of Energy that is centrally focused, that's accountable, transparent, it's a good governance structure. We do want to diversify generation, particularly from our perspective, to increase renewables, because we believe that's clean energy, it's decentralized, and when you have small decentralized generation, we would support what the trade unions are saying, that this gives you opportunity for small business and job creation, local ownership, you know, which we believe is a good way to go. We think that transmission needs to match the electricity planning, and I'll raise a bit later some of the comments, questions we have around the current renewable energy process. And then I think one thing which hasn't really been raised in the submissions to date is this issue, when we're looking at electricity planning and we need to ensure that we take demand side management and efficiency into account as much as supply. The cheapest form of supply is actually efficiency. So when we're looking at tariffs, we shouldn't just be looking at an expansion plan. We need to look at a proper integrated process. And slide that the Department of Energy's capabilities sometimes are not up to what they should, and therefore there's a reliance on the private sector, particularly large companies, to advise, for advice. Eskom, and I refer to the slide from the previous submission, has not implemented renewables. And the idea of transmission aligning to generation, it's very much at the moment what we understand the transmission plan to be aligned to Eskom's long-term planning, which does not really deal with the decentralized renewable energy. If you continue having transmission located under the control of Eskom generation, then we believe that that's what they will plan for. And then the modeling capability is definitely there, but at senior levels of Eskom, there seems to be a lack of political will for energy efficiency. And again, we would point to the tariff structure. There's no incentive. If you sell electricity, there's no incentive for you to save it because then that reduces your income. So within that context, we just want to emphasize that we believe that the Department of Energy is running on a sort of panel beat the plane while you fly it. And so things like are likely to wobble. And therefore we need to look at the context of the ISMO within that, that we're all trying to get maybe to the same point. We would like to know where the Department of Energy is heading because it's also useful. But we'll work together, and that's what we would like to do. So coming to the bill and this issue of transmission and where you put it. So at the top, what we would see is this is where we have it at the moment. We've got generation, transmission, the gizmo, and distribution, all in one big thing called Eskom. And then we've got sort of households or small businesses or industry that get supplied. So what we are proposing to do, as we understand it, is keep the transmission within Eskom, have this next separate thing called the ISMO, and then presumably Eskom distribution will sort of somehow be linked back into the main Eskom, and then we have households. So practically where the line is drawn at which substation is obviously a question. And then we think that what we end up doing is how is the ISMO actually going to control transmission, particularly in terms of planning and procuring. And just to raise at this juncture that in the rebid process, what we understand has happened is that because the decision as to the IPPs was made at central government level, and now those bidders have been told they must get the house in order to be organized, get access to the grid by a certain timeline, but Eskom is now saying that we can't take you onto the grid at that point because we don't have grid capability at that particular geographical location because we didn't plan for you guys to be there. So if you have a transmission that's running in one direction and a whole lot of IPPs in another, then it's very difficult to see how these are going to cooperate. So in terms of what we would like to see is the transmission is with ISMO. We think that's fundamental. We fully support there must be some sort of phasing. It's not instantaneous. It's a difficult process. But we believe that it needs to be put into the bill, that the transmission will be part of it. Otherwise, what you're going to have, I believe, is another piece of legislation coming, which will now set up a transmission company later stage, and then it would just be to in our case, we think that it can be done here, and then in the transitional arrangements, maybe timelines and phasing can be placed. Okay, then if we look at how ISMO relates to planning, things have gone, the arrows, something's gone slightly off there, but it's all right. Deal with that. So you have the Department of Energy. Now, this issue of planning, there's been discussion about planning being part of the ISMO. And we would say we don't support that. Because when you plan, you must plan at a broader level. You must plan electricity and energy for the country. So you must the national growth path, which may mean that you need to plan that these are growth sectors in the economy, these are areas in the country where we are developing, and therefore this is where our electricity infrastructure must support. So that is not something to me that is left at the electricity procurement and balancing and scheduling aspect. Planning is a much broader than just electricity. Electricity is a subset. So, and the IRP will then depend on that planning. Once the IRP is finalized, and within it being an iterative process, then that to me is handed to the ISMO. Obviously, the ISMO must be involved in that, and said, okay, guys, run with that. Go and procure generation, manage whatever, schedule it in order to achieve this, because this IRP is what we have determined is in the national interest. So we don't think that you can put the national interest into one small subsector of energy. It would be scheduling, procurement, everything else can go, yes. We also think in terms of, it's important that we do have at the policy level the purple spots of public participation, and at the IRP we need strong public participation. And then where we would see also the need is a strong independent regulator that can regulate tariffs that are to ensure they're in the national interest and to enforce license conditions. And we can come to some other issues around energy choice and wheeling, which I think can be dealt with there. And then the ISMO would then buy power from whichever, whether it's ESCOM or IPPs, and those ESCOM generation or IPPs would have to get a license from NERSA. And for example, to address the carbon issue, is if the policy that NERSA has to implement says there will be no more fossil fuel power stations, then IPPs will not be able to get a license if they are coal-fired or whatever. But that can be controlled through that. From the bill, what we understand is there's a disjuncture in terms of the ISMO and the other legislation which is coming up, the amendments, and so I understood from NERSA that there was some sort of exemption to enable the ISMO to carry on at the moment. So this is a kind of panel beating while flying approach that we need to get things going. And then in terms of, we would like to see when the ISMO does input their data into the planning function that there should be more public participation and debate around that. And then we would also like to see increased parliamentary oversight. We've made some specific comments on that. But so that we see planning is not just done by a small group of people in a room, but actually it should be opened up a little bit more and very much more transparent. Now, the ISMO bill, we'll go into some of the small things that we've totally supported. We think that there is a real need to have an ISMO. We are concerned about ownership, and particularly the setting up of a state-owned enterprise. Our concerns are more to do with what does this imply, and I'll pick up a couple of points a bit later in terms of the detail. Now, it was raised in earlier submissions, and it's one of our key concerns is the amendments to the Electricity Regulation Act and the National Electricity Regulator Act seem to completely overturn this idea of a regulated energy sector where people have their own roles and it runs in a form of good governance. And this, we're not here to discuss those two amendments, but I felt it was important to highlight that from our perspective, this is what happens with those amendments, is that the minister can decide who gets licenses, determine the tariffs, put in the conditions, NERSA is forced to actually implement, even if the tariff, for example, would not be in the national interest. The IRP is suddenly optional and can be put on one side. And in terms of finalizing plans and even buying generation, that's all resolved. So we really are very concerned about the amendments and how they impact and whether we are just creating now an ISMO, which in fact can't function. So we would appeal to the committee to really look carefully at that legislation as a whole. And the idea is, just graphically, that if we don't address that, then our plane that is flying is literally going to burn up and crash. So we would definitely support the transmission infrastructure being part of the ISMO. We definitely would like to see ISMO as a not-for-profit state institution. And I just want to refer you in that instance, in the Energy Act, I think it's Section 7, the SEF was split and SANEDI was taken out of SEF. And it simply is a state institution with a board. And as far as I understand, and I've spoken to a couple of people, it's not a state-owned enterprise. It's set up differently. So it's not that there isn't a precedent. However, if it needs to be a state-owned enterprise, then in the schedules of the PFMA, there's different types of state-owned enterprises, not my area of expertise, but some of them are like the CSIR or organizations that seem to be very much not for profit, as it were. So that is one of the issues. Now, the big elephant in the room, which hasn't been raised as far as we understand by any other input so far, which we would like to raise, is where is the Department of Public Enterprises and why are they not involved here? Because our understanding is that it's the Department of Public Enterprises that owns ESCOM. And if ESCOM is going to have a piece taken out of it or function, is there not some amendment or some ESCOM-related legislation, or is there not something that the ESCOM owner would need to have a say in? We raise this in genuine concern because it's our understanding that the way that some of ESCOM's activities have been running is that there is a conflict between the Department of Public Enterprise sometimes and the Department of Energy, and that this is an issue that makes it difficult. So there needs to be one boss. The ISMO sets up the Minister of Energy as the boss, which is great, but then it's just a concern that what role does the Department of Public Enterprises play? So we would just like to understand, and we have set up a mission both to the department, where we did not get any response, and here, that what we would like to do is understand what is that. So just to quickly look through, on our submission, I think one of the issues that we would like to look at is environmental best practice. That this is an energy body, and it was raised by one of the submissions, I think, yesterday, that the environment has got something to do with some other body and not in energy, whereas we would see that there's a strong need to integrate. And I just want to point you to NERSA, who, as we have raised with them consistently, should be looking at environmental issues. And what that would mean is that in the tariff setting, for example, they should look at the cost of externalities in terms of coal. They fall under NEMA as a state institution, but it never happens. And their web page is constantly, on their environmental page, is constantly under construction. So we would like to maybe just make a point that somehow the environmental and social mandates of whatever state institution should be included. And I'm just checking that I haven't certain. There's a few points that we would like to point. I think we also share some of the Labour NUMSA's concerns about the AIM and the memorandum and where are we going, and that our perspective would be that we do not want such a critical piece of infrastructure as the National private equity partners may in fact lead to then us ending up with China controlling our national infrastructure as a sort of semi-joke. And so in the first version of the bill, there was a section which said that despite the provisions of the Company Act, the government would be as long as it wishes the only member of the company in terms of the ISMO. So that raises serious questions like, what does that mean? That the state would remain the sole stakeholder as long as it wishes, and then maybe when it doesn't wish to. So this raises, you know, we would like to see that, and it has been changed, so we welcome that, but it's a concern. And similarly, there was a statement which says, for as long as ISMO remains a public entity, in the initial phrasing. So we are glad that it's changed, but we are concerned about the motivation behind setting up the ISMO, and something which we didn't pick up, but I would like to support from Labour yesterday, was the idea of subsidiaries of ISMO. We would like to see that removed. It seems to speak to the same thing, which is a concern about that critical in terms of national energy security. These are functions that should remain within the state control, solely within the state control. I think that's more or less. Yeah, there was a few things about having exemptions from any other act and the sole discretion of the minister. We are a little concerned about statements like that, but they have been changed, and we're very welcome for that. Just some small things is, and again, these may be norms, but we want to just question them, is senior staff are on contract for periods of, I think, 8 years. Why? If a person is a career person, then if they enter an institution and they find they only have an 8-year term, then they must move. Will they really be interested in actually developing that institution in the long term, or are they simply there to get what they can and then they move? Also, then do we not have revolving doors where people are at the ISMO 1 year, nurses another year, ESCOM? Is this good or bad? I don't know. We're just raising it. That why do we not have permanent tenure? And then there's a small thing which talks about ISMO and expansion planning. And we just think that the terminology is wrong. Yes, right now we may be in a system of expansion, but we're hoping that the piece of law does not get changed every few years. And at some point it will just be about planning with the steady state, not necessarily expanding continuously. So we just think that it will reach an optimal, and therefore the word expansion is maybe not necessary in the law. We would really like to hear from the law advisors and others about GPE. I think just Section 39 talks to policies, and we just think, I think it's more or less okay, but issues around parliamentary oversight, we would like to see. I'm just sorry, checking that I. An honourable member is actually not in the room at the moment, but it was something that I wanted to raise around the wheeling issue. Chair, maybe just to say, NERSA released some rules on wheeling. We were involved in the refit committee advising NERSA. We've been involved in an IRP analysis. We've been involved in various processes through a body called the Energy Electricity Governance Initiative. And one of the issues that is a conundrum, which is applicable to ISMO, is we would like to say that if you are a business and you are wanting to get your electricity from a source which is now not an ESCOM source, that you should be able to set up an IPP wield that power through the grid and supply your business. And we can put constraints and say it can't be coal, it could be renewable. That can be a policy framework. But the question comes, say they choose to do that because it is cheaper than Eskom power. That means that there are then a much less number of customers who must bear the cost of providing that power, which might then mean that the tariff must go up in order to recover the costs. Because potentially you have built infrastructure for that large player, only to find that the large player doesn't want it anymore because it's expensive, which relates to your choice of energy that you chose. So it's a bit complicated. However, if you forbid, this was a question also put out, if you say, okay, we're not allowing anybody to build their own power stations and just wheel, that actually it's all going to be blended and that there's one price through ISMO. You sell to ISMO and you buy. You can't just wheel it through the grid. Then the question comes that if, again, relating to your energy choice, you then make the decision to invest in the most expensive, and we specifically would say, for example, the nuclear fleet, then what you end up with is big businesses which might then start saying, well, actually the electricity in South Africa is too high, and therefore we are going to move into Botswana or somewhere else. So I'm just saying it's a bit of a balancing act. And to me, the ISMO is going to potentially be the body that's going to have to deal with that. It's maybe a bit for discussion. There's lots of other stuff, but I think that's the main point, and we are also very willing to assist in terms of, how we resolve some of these issues. So basically we think the transitional arrangements, we need to put transmission into the ISMO and then put a time frame. We need to ensure there's a strong public participation and oversight function, parliamentary oversight and strong public participation, in order to ensure that you have transparent and open, accountable governance. And then just to end on a quote, is that we need strong leadership that can also be inspirational. In your packs, there's actually an extra slide which committee secretary printed, which was actually hidden in my PowerPoint because it was only in case of we got into the demand side of discussions, but this is where I'm ending, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mokdate. I almost had a heart attack. I was looking at my submission from you, which I made comments on, and I saw the earlier one. So now am I getting you off the hook? But I got it. Let me allow members to make comments, questions. Okay, Honorable Fayu, Mama Tibet. Oh, Punga. Then I'll give some time, Honorable Smart. You see, you're still doing your mathematical calculations there. Okay, Honorable Fayu.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Well, taking the presenter's invitation to debate some of these issues, let me try and do that. Just on the wheeling issue, which obviously has come up a lot, my feeling around the wheeling is that I fail to see, I mean, I might be wrong, how any new generation plant would be able to compete with the blended tariff at this stage. So I think the issue that you raise in that, a big energy smelter or big energy user would contract with an IPP and then be getting electricity at a cheaper price than what they would be able to buy it from the ISMA in terms of the blended price, I don't think is necessarily a concern for the simple reason that there's a number of coal-fired power stations, old ones, that are producing at 5 cents a kilowatt hour. So when you blend that price, should come, it should be less than an IPP, and if we're not, then there's serious question marks over ESCOM's new build and how expensive that is. So I don't necessarily foresee a big problem there. I think the problem would be whether big energy users would want to enter into contracts with IPPs, given that the blended price would probably be lower. But, you know, for security of supply reasons, I think that might be a reason for them to do so. So that would be my contribution to that debate. Just then on the issue of planning, and we've had a lot of discussion, some people coming out in favor of ISMO taking the planning functions over from the minister and the department, others saying no. I mean, I think that we can find a medium between this. I think the reason why people are saying planning should rest with ISMO is that they believe that we need to build up the technical capacity, and that ISMO is the place to build the technical capacity around modeling and planning, because they have to deal with it on a daily basis. And I buy that argument, and I think that does need to do it. But obviously their plans need to be informed by a set of priorities, national priorities, which set the framework for which that planning can take place in. So perhaps we should be wary enough to say that the priorities and the kind of assumptions that gets put into the planning model that ISMO then does get set by the department and get set by the minister, but that the actual technical work gets done by ISMO. Perhaps that's a way of resolving that particular conflict, and I'll be interested to hear your views on that. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the submission. I've got a question here about the ISMO buying, where other people like Salga were saying that ISMO buying from ESCOM. Is ISMO going to buy from ESCOM, or is ESCOM going to buy from ISMO? I don't understand well what's going on there. The next one is about the building of power stations. I don't know, what is your take there about building when people building at power stations? What are we going to do with our natural resources? I thought with our natural resources we will be looking at the technology, if that's going to help for us to use our natural resources of South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the presentation. Chair, probably the question that has been asked in relation to the stakeholders that are within the ISMO, I think it's some of the other things that must be able to be clarified by the department. But the last engagement with the department, they informed us that public enterprise is part of the stakeholder, economic development is part of the stakeholder, you know, the planning commission as well, because those are the stakeholders that also must deal with the issue of the plan of the security of supply of electricity. So I think your answer can be answered in that way, in that regard. But your question to say whether the government will remain part solidly participatory within the ISMO when it likes. The initial initiation of the ISMO is that ISMO is going to be an SOE. Therefore, government must take part of the role, because at some certain point, the accountability comes to government. Therefore, the role is very much important that government must see it fit that it takes part in terms of that. Maybe the question that should be answered as you are words you are asking to see, maybe a clarity should be given to say, what is the meaning of saying when it likes? Because it must have a specification to say, going to remain part of the ISMO or not. I think that's one of the other things. I think there are a lot of things that you've engaged about that I think we should be able to look at them and ensure that as a portfolio committee, how do we comment in terms of them and ensure that you assist in alleviating some of the fears. But lastly, Chairperson, in terms of the issue around the position of top management, that you are questioning to say why should it be permanent? Well, the norm is that it's just like when you come to the new governance. You know, the typical example of one of the other issues that is dominated newspapers when the Democratic Alliance took over the Cape Town mayoralship. They fired the competent municipal manager there. But would they like to say they want to get a person that thinks is going to serve probably their perspective, mind, and ideology? Not looking into national broader perspective and needs of the crowd within the people. So I'm saying, every time when there is a new structure, because if you look at your bill, it gives you an information in terms of the Section 10 form to say the members of the board, their time frame is going to be 4 years. Therefore, within that 4 years, they must appoint probably the management that's going to work with them. That's going to understand them and their objectives that they want to drive the ISMO to. So therefore, my thinking is that when they reappoint, when a new board is going to be appointed, the contract of these other ones will be finished. But if the new board comes in, see fit that they can reinstate this person and continue with the contract, you know, they can still do so. Because it must be about the capability of a person and whether a person can be able to adjust and redirect the focus of what is needed, because you don't, you know, at most cases when you give a person a comfortable seat, a person doesn't, well, if it doesn't perform very well, you don't have any obligation to fire a person, because it doesn't matter whether a person performs well or doesn't perform well. But when you give a time frame of a person, you know that my time frame finishes within this person's time, therefore I must perform very well, so that at least they can reinstate me. So I think you must be able to understand in that light to say a person can be reinstated in terms of his or her performance, not in terms of whether you want to create sustainability whatsoever. Because sustainability can be only created by a person, by performance of an individual. Thank you, Chairperson.
I'll just latch on that one last one, and just to say that shouldn't there then be a clear distinction between administrative personnel and board? Therefore, the time period in that. But my question actually relates to your concerns about the exemption of certain conditions as per your submissions, especially. Call it like a sort of a blanket that the Minister of Trade and Industry or one of the other ministers can do. Would you want to see that this exemption only applies for the transfer of assets from Eskom to ISMO at that stage, and it stops there, and at making sure that the playing fields with the various IPPs later on is then on an equal footage? I just would like to understand that, and maybe you can elaborate on you know, what is the warning lights? Where do you see certain things that can go wrong? Maybe an example or something. The second one is referred to in one of your submissions, in your written submissions, you said that the provision of the bill not supplying information in a transparent manner. But however, in some way, it is addressed, but you still got concerns that it's not enough. I went to the bill and it talks to that the minister can acquire any such information that is needed. Is there still a vacuum? You know, what must still be added in order to make sure that proper accountability actually takes place and that we do secure energy supply or action that needs to be taken? I just would like to understand where the vacuum still lies. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Just the right time to take a break. Well, I can hear this. The cutler is making noise. That will give Mama Magdeed enough time to prepare responses. 10 minute break, honorable members.
Thank you.
Can you settle? Welcome, Karyapa. It's over to the Institute. Now, thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Just important to frame our responses in when we're looking at all of these legislative amendments, the governance issues, we need to frame it in whose interests are we doing this. I think from our perspective, our interests are the ordinary citizens of South Africa, which unfortunately is particularly the poor. And how does this impact, and how do we ensure that we address poverty and provide opportunities in terms of access? And so, within that paradigm, is the frame that we've looked at it. So I'll come back. To the wheeling issue. But part of the question about the blending and the new generation competing is, yes, you're correct at the moment. As we go into the future and we build new generation, it's certainly sure that we are never going to be building coal power power stations at the price of the old ones. So that blended price is going to go one way. If we build Medupi, we've got Kusile coming online. The other issue is, at the moment, our IRP points to big batch of nuclear, we know that's very expensive. So we also look at some of the renewable costs which are coming down over time, and certain technologies are cheaper than others. So depending what your business is, it may be in the future that you are going to be able to provide electricity cheaper than the blended price. The other issue is the carbon tax and climate change and these kinds of influences and what influence that will have on electricity prices. So I think we're in a very dynamic global situation, and one cannot make the assumption that into the future the blended price is going to be cheap for a long time. In terms of technical planning. I think that my understanding from discussions with Eskom is that the staff, the technical guys who are going to be within the ISMO under their current plan that they presented to us, do have technical skills to do that planning. And I think the idea being that that technical information, that modeling, would be done within ISMO and then fed in the department as part of their overarching planning. Maybe we can unpack a little bit more how the planning function would work and who would have responsibility for what. But at the moment what we have is Eskom doing all the electricity planning, and it is very clear that they operate on a supply-driven model. They are really not giving much weight to efficiency and demand-side management. And they also only focus on electricity. And electricity is one subsector of energy. If we were to implement solar water heaters on every house, excuse me, our load profile might shift quite substantially. And that's an issue where should the electricity planner be taking responsibility for the implementation and rollout of solar water heaters? I would say maybe not. That they would have to take into consideration a government directive to do so. In terms of customers, this is an interesting thing, because if you are within a municipality, then Eskom would generate electricity, feed it, sell it to the ISMO would buy it, and then sell it into the municipality, who would sell it to the household. If you are an ESCOM customer, the distribution belongs to ESCOM, then my assumption is ESCOM will generate the power, sell it to the ISMO will buy it, sell it to a distribution network. And this is where it becomes complicated because, and this is our concern about each one being a state-owned enterprise, which then has to be financially viable and make some return to the state, because in each one of those steps, then one can assume that everyone will add their little bit on. So I think there are questions about that, and that's why part of our issue around pricing is that we would like to see the ISMO as not having to make any return. And then I'll come back to your question, because I just want to talk about the stakeholders. Yes, all the different departments can be stakeholders, but then is there a conflict? And what happens if there's a conflict? Because the Department of Public Enterprises has a mandate to do to run, my understanding is they want to run institutions for the benefit of the state in terms of getting a return. Pay tax, they get dividends, which means they want them to make money. We are looking at the ISMO as an institution to facilitate access to the grid and to ensure that people can get electricity, presumably under NERSA, which says we want the tariffs to be low in terms of access. We don't want people to have to pay very high prices. I believe that that can be a conflict. I think we'd have to ask ESCOM for experiences of that. I have some knowledge, but I don't think I can share it. It's rumor. So for me, those are questions. Just to come back to our natural resources, I think, yes, we do want to use our natural resources, but those natural resources include the sun, the wind, the tides, and all of those other natural resources which are underutilized at the moment. And somebody has to do an analysis and say, where do we get the best electricity per rand, or hopefully that's not the only institution, but which one will deliver the most jobs, which will provide the most the electricity which is reliable, which will ensure the greatest number of people can access that electricity. How do we create the right mix and the right structure of delivery? So decentralized electricity, mini-grid, local ownership, you know, also this issue of cooperatives, all of that comes in. So, yes, we need to use our natural resources, but all of them. And we need to make some priority decisions. I mean, completely different debate, but we don't believe that that the fracking is a good idea either. But that's a different debate. But just to also say, in terms of access, and I'm talking access of poor people to electricity, is that there's a recent article which spoke about Italy having put 9,000 megawatts of solar PV power on the roofs in 1 year. That's an enormous amount of electricity, and presumably that is purely for local use. Our system, if we had a system that could do that, we could be ensuring that every household in the country had access to electricity very rapidly. And we would grow an industry. We have a very small PV industry in the country. So jobs, economic development. Someone has to do that overall analysis. And for me, that's not the ISMO's job to do that overall analysis. That is what government, that's the minister's job. That's a policy framework. Bit more than that. Part of the questions around when it lags, the underlying fear. I think in terms of when you have statements in legislation which says this can remain in state hands until the state decides that it's not going to, there is an underlying indication that at some point it is going to decide that it doesn't want to be the shareholder anymore. And that is the way open for private entities. And I think, personally, that I would not like to have a central function such as the control of electricity in the hands of the private sector, or in the hands of a sector whose aim in life is to generate profits. I do not think that's beneficial for the majority of citizens of South Africa. That is our concern. We would like to ensure that the legislation does not allow that. In terms of management, yeah, this issue of performance, I think performance agreements is a good idea. And yes, people can be very comfortable in long-term jobs, but maybe then it needs to be turned around, and I would leave that to my Labour comrades to pick up. But is it not then better to say that it will be renewed if your performance is good, rather than saying it will be cancelled unless your performance is? It's just like a wavier way of treating people. But in terms of the board timeframes, I was just having a quick look at the Act. I think the issue around continuity is just to ensure that there is some continuity, and I think the way it's worded at the moment is kind of may. So you don't want a completely new board every 4 years. My recollection is that at the moment it's worded that there can be continuity, but it's not mandatory. And that was just to relate to that. In terms of what can go wrong in terms of equal footing or level playing fields, I think it's the issue of who decides who has access to the grid. And I think it's been raised in terms of by other players. So just if Eskom has a power station over there, and it also has a transmission plan, and it also knows it wants to produce power stations over there and there on the basis of its own demand planning, then there's a limited number of resources that Eskom has. It either puts the grid there where it thinks it should go, or it puts it somewhere else. If it has no control over the power stations that are being built over there, because that's somebody else's job, then if I was Eskom, I would say, well, I'm not going to build those ones because I don't know whether they're really going to come into fruition. I'll go with the ones I have control over. What happens then is those guys, which is what's happened now, is those guys have been given permission by another state entity, as in this case the minister, to build their power stations. They've put their money in, and now Eskom's saying, yeah, but we can't get the grid to you. We can't access, you can't get the grid. So there are all sorts of problems if you split this transmission from the decision of who's procuring and allocating. That's what I would suggest. In terms of the provision of information, yes, the minister can access information, but I think the issue is we want active citizens. We want to have more transparency, and more transparency builds, in our sense, builds stability, because people can interrogate, we can have discussion. And in one of my things I submitted was examples from other system operators, and in one of them, one of the functions was to produce some public information at a regular basis, so that one can see what is actually happening, which gives everyone an opportunity to engage and debate. I think I covered that round of questions.
Thank you very much. Last page of the bill
surprise to have even come to make an oral presentation. Neither of those are not around. I don't know why. You make reference in your submission of a 1998 Harvard paper describing an independent operator, and even list some of them, although the print is extremely small there. I don't know. Why were you not creative enough to give us a bigger print? But can you share this 1998 Harvard paper with the committee? It would be helpful for us to get to know other ISOs in any case. Those who are referring to the contention that ESCOM is to all intents and purposes a private company acting in the interest of large industrial customers. The state has failed to provide direction and control to force this monopoly to act in the public interest. Surely would welcome a proof of that so that we can have ESCOM to respond to that. Because there's quite a number of us have alluded. Whilst we're handling just the deed, because this will impact on other things, but obviously some of the serious statements that are raised here would definitely will take them on board as we move along, lest we miss out something that would have helped us to remedy what your presentation, and you've got the ALA submission, so I had to check. I'm almost tempted to comment on this thing that ESCOM has a modern capacity but lacks political will for energy efficiency. See, what strikes me there is that ESCOM has just taken up 49M campaign, and I thought political will would actually stem from the Department of Public Enterprise, as the Makulu boss, the shareholder and the boss of ESCOM. As I say, I'm just tempted. I'm tempted. I know it's not an answerable forecast yet. I take a point that planning has got to be much broader than just electricity and the subset of the energy. But I suppose you also would concede that now that integrated energy planning process has been triggered, let's all put our shoulders on the wheel to ensure that that brings about the desired broader outcome, so that we can work with more confidence in the future. Mr. McBeat, how do you see this increase of parliamentary oversight? Obviously, when it comes to that, we're very, very keen. When the time comes for ERA, the ease of the what has made reference there, that there'll be public participation in sheriff hearings, but the minister can still dictate tariffs. I'm sure we'll be waiting with keen interest for us to, you know, clarify that. Of course,
course, we take note of the fact that there are supposed to be legislative changes in the ESCOM Act. I mean, if we have certain functions that are being taken out, it's logical that there should be a corresponding rearrangement. We'll have spoken to our parliamentary legal advisor to look into that, pretty seriously. In fact, your institute is the only one that has raised that. I hope I'm right in the submission, honorable members. One of the suggestions is about public participation on two areas, procurement and planning. I would like to take up planning because I know there could be quite a number of issues that look into that. But in terms of procurement, my understanding was that procurement has got certain procedures, regulations, and standards. Now, how would public participate in procurement within this bill? Yeah, that's all for now. Thank you.
I've run out of page on the paper space to write, so I think I'll go hold there. In terms of, yes, there are other SOEs under public enterprises, and I actually looked at the schedules of the PFMA. There's like two different schedules, a Schedule 2 and a Schedule 3. And it seemed, and again, this is not my area of expertise, I looked specifically because I had a concern around this, and I've asked other people, and it seems that certain of the schedules, of which ESCOM is one, are around deriving an income, return taxes, dividends, etc. And then the others are like the CSIR or others where it seems to be more, it's just a structure, but its function is not necessarily to derive what I would call profits. So maybe that is the distinction that one needs to make and ensure that the ISMO is basically not operating in a profit-driven space. Willingly share the Harvard paper, and apologies for the layout. Just trying to save paper, environmentally friendly. Just to say, the reason I just put some of those in is just the wording that from some of those other ISMOs in terms of the wording of the function seemed quite nice. One of them was around having the ability to make short-term arrangements to ensure that there is security of supply. You know, if you need to act in a hurry because there's some problem, a constraint in the system, then you must have the freedom to do that. And there was a wording that I thought might be useful to add to our wording. So that's where that comes from. In terms of the vested interest, now I have to turn to my hidden slide. So if you indulge me for a couple of minutes, this is from the IRP. How do I make this thing go bigger? Okay, there must be a... Okay. A repo. Should be... Yeah, there we go. Yeah. This one? Yeah. Okay. Sorry. This was the... done as part of a group of NGOs that looked at the analysis of the IRP. And basically, very, very simply, ESCOM explained that the way they do the demand is they look at sort of what the historical growth has been, and they go and interview their key industrial customers or players and ask them what projects they have in the pipeline and what their future demand will be. And and then we build according to that. So, and I just want to refer you to where it says 2010, and then there's two short little red things. And I'm now working on memories, and I can't read the key underneath there, but white one, I think, is the municipalities, the purple one, and the yellow one, or no, maybe this is, anyway, these are industrial, they have key industrial, I think, steel, chrome, ferrochrome, and iron and steel. So, in other words, what we are building, and what we are responding to is the key industrial customers' interest into the future. That's what we are planning our electricity expansion on. But that expansion is not, there's a risk to it, because if our electricity prices go too high, then those industrial customers may change their mind, go somewhere else. We've got no guarantee that that forecast is going to come to fruition. The global downturn, we may not deliver on that. And in fact, in the 1970s, South Africa built too much capacity, which is then what has resulted with these special deals, is because now there was so much capacity that they looked for people to buy it. And there comes someone and says, well, I'll come, but I don't want like your price, I'll only pay this much. And rather than get nothing, you at least accept some customers. So our concern is that who is driving this demand? And we've produced an analysis, we've got documentation, there's an advisory committee that was put in place on the IOP, and that advisory committee, and somewhere on my computer I have the slide of members, and that was mostly big industrial players. So that's who's advising the electricity demand, and obviously they would very much like the state to take the risk in building this huge infrastructure for electricity generation on the basis that then in 5-10 years, if they feel like it, they can build their projects and they can buy that electricity. But there's no guarantee that they're going to do that. So that is, and I mean, I haven't come here prepared to talk at length on that, but I can certainly provide the analysis that we gave in terms of that. And there were, you know, one or two other experts, one or two several expert opinions in terms of energy planning and electrical infrastructure who can talk to this in depth as well. So how we do our demand planning is very critical, and that speaks to the issue I was raising earlier, was if you have the ability to buy your electricity either from the Eskom blended price or the ISMO blended price or your own power plant, then the ferrochrome smelter that told DOE, I need 5,000 megawatts in 10 years' time, when it comes to 10 years' time, looks at the price that this generation is available at, electricity is available, and then looks at whether it wouldn't be cheaper for them to build their own generator, and they choose the cheapest, leaving the state with a lot of capacity that it doesn't necessarily need. And then it is the citizens, and again, I want to come back, it is because of the cost recovery, it is then Eskom would have to recover the costs of that capital infrastructure, and it would therefore need to do that through raised prices to its captive customers, which would mostly be the poor. So, very short input, but we could speak to that in more depth. Yes, Eskom has got a saving campaign, and I have to refer back to discussions I've had with Eskom over the years, is that demand side and energy efficiency come in when they've run out of power. And it's generally seen as a temporary solution until we build more power stations. I mean, even the talk of things at the moment is once Medupi comes online, once Kusile, then we won't have a power shortage. But we need to look at the best use of our electricity, and is just building new generation each time the correct way to do it. So, in terms of parliamentary oversight, again, I am not sure whether members of parliament had an input into, for example, the IRP, looking at the assumptions and the policy framework that guided the IRP. Is the IEP, is there a scheduled kind of, are you part of the process of oversight in terms of looking at what are the assumptions, or is your role like any other member of the public? Because my understanding is that members of parliament would have an oversight role to ensure that the planning process that has been undertaken is in the public interest, that it is taking into account the need to develop the economy in a certain way, and that should be scheduled as part of the formal preparation of such a document. Potentially maybe even public hearings on the final or some other, I wouldn't dictate, but just to ensure that the planning is not happening purely on the supply-driven side. I have prepared inputs on the electricity regulation and the National Electricity Act Regulation Act amendments, and I will send those inputs to the committee. That's on the draft that was released by the DOE, and one hopes and presumes they have a second draft when they'll bring to Parliament. But we can send you comments on the initial draft.
No, that's not the rush.
Okay.
You'll have to wait for Netflix.
No, I'm not quite sure what question you asked there, because I've got the answer, but it was about ESCOM legislation. The amendments. Yes, in terms of DPE. Yes, it's a question of clarity, because we had assumed that if there was a need to amend some ESCOM act or that falls specifically, this is an act to establish a body. If there is another act which covers those functions, then is there not a need for that act to be amended at the same time? I'm not sure, but if so, it would seem that I think the President made reference to the ISMO 2 years ago in the State of the Nation address, and so should we not be trying to speed up, not delay things? In terms of procurement and planning and public interest, now, I just have to relate a short story, if you don't mind, and that is with the rebid process. I think it's already been mentioned that it was not that there is any indication or intention to meddle. I think to meddle in tender processes, that procurement processes certainly should not be. But in terms of the call for proposals, such documents are normally in the public arena, so that people can have a look at them and see what is the content. And I think the NUMSA rep raised that, in fact, you couldn't even get a hold of that unless you were prepared to pay 5,000 rand. I received a call from a fishing community on the West Coast to ask, you know, they've been approached by some foreign investment company, and you know, they've been told they can get involved in this, but they're not sure if they should, they're not sure what the benefit is, and they're not sure how this will work for them. Now, that community is going to be, ripped off, very likely, because here is a big player coming in who has hold all the cards and can simply say to them that the risk of that, you guys sign here, and, you know, we'll give you a few thousand rand a year. For a poor community, that is a benefit. We've seen this happen in the fishing industry. Seen that happen with the attempts to restructure the fishing industry. The teachers in Gauteng suddenly became holders of fishing rights. So it's a really unfortunate issue around transparency. So it's not to meddle in a procurement process, but to ensure that the playing fields are level and everyone has access. Because development NGOs then could assist communities to ensure that they have rights. And then my last comment was in terms of stakeholders and maybe public participation, the stakeholders on is a good idea, but I was tossing around in my head, so I'm just putting it out there, is the NUMSA government raised the issue of electricity council. I think one needs to look a bit higher and say maybe we need an energy council, which would be an advisory body of stakeholders to the minister. Not just on electricity, but possibly that to strengthen the policy development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's quite helpful. Those intense triggers more questions. Of course, there's a difference between public participation and transparency in procurement process. But we'll leave that to the department to sort that out for us. Because we definitely, all of our members would be chittered about public participation in procurement. Because with the first window, what we got is that even the international aspects were quite heavy about the process, how the process went on. And that's with their internal experiences, there were still flaws. The Parliament oversight role, I'm sure it can only be enhanced. We definitely, without elaborating my response on that, because we're not at that level, whenever any issue at hand warrants public participation, we do so. Not only this committee, but other committees. But I mean, if it's something that is really very, very mundane, we should just allow it to go through without public participation, because it may not be that significant. But there are guidelines on that. And as we have already displayed, and I'm sure this will be a trend, that in this arena, and even others, will definitely, when time is appropriate and right, invite this department. The department is expected to go for another round this year on the IRP, and automatically will be part of that process where they'll brief us. I was invited to the colloquium, which is more or less some kind of a public launch of the integrated energy planning. And I can only share with the members that I really appreciate how complex that process is. So definitely, we will, wait until something is of appropriate consumption for the committee to get a briefing. All the members, I think we've come to the conclusion of today's deliberations. Let me thank everyone for coming. But before we disperse, we have been invited by the Minister of Energy, all of us as members, to attend NCOP budget vote speech at 2:00 tomorrow, NCOP chambers, and also will be invited to lunch at the National Assembly restaurant at 12:00. But please, yes, not today. If you could send your RSVPs today. Okay. Next week, Tuesday, sharp at 9:00, we'll be getting responses from the Department of Energy on all the submissions. I think for now, we'll have to use the coming few days just to refresh ourselves. Had quite a pounding from various presentations. And once again, let me highlight in quite a number of instances, some of the presentations had
final submission. So we've got to just be alert on that. Unfortunately, we don't have a researcher who would have helped to summarize the submissions for us. I'm still quite behind in working very hard to see how can that be filled in. From time to time, one chief